Everybody. I'm Jason Tondo. I am a developer on the Starfinder role-playing game at Paizo. And over the last month or so, and for a couple of months to come, I'm going to be doing a deep dive on Starfinder's current adventure path, Fly Free or Die. I was the lead developer for this adventure path, 6 volumes. The first volume came out in November. And I'm kind of using these developer diaries as kind of a director's commentary on it, but also as a way to kind of reflect on what I learned about the process, about how adventure paths come together and how they go from outline to first draft to published product. And I want to encourage you to check out the previous chapters in this series. This is chapter 3. This is part 3 of what I anticipate to be an 8-part series. In the first, we talked about all of the pre stuff, like pitching the idea and coming up with the idea in the first place, getting outlines written and approved, and then hiring writers. Chapter 2 of this series discussed the first volume in the adventure path. I want to say Fly Free or Die, but of course that's not it. That's the name of the entire adventure path. This happens to be a lot. This is why I take notes. We're No Heroes. We're No Heroes is the first volume. And so I did that last chapter. In this chapter, we're going to talk about volume 2 in the series, which is incredibly important to the whole adventure path. And we'll talk about a lot of the reasons why. And I put the cover up here for you to take a look at, Merchants of the Void. It's got a fantastic view of the Oliphant, which is something that we're going to start off talking about right away, the starship that the PCs steal and fly for most of this AP, and also the captain of the so-called rival crew, Neva Rovo. And we'll talk about the rival crew and their role in the adventure path in a minute. Often these covers end up putting the adversary on the front. But Neva is not the primary antagonist of this volume. She is a recurring character. Her and her crew are a recurring character, and they have a key role in making this adventure path feel different than any other adventure path you've ever played. And so we'll get to that in a minute. And my thought is just to kind of walk us through this project and figure out kind of what was I going for and what were my inspirations and what panned out and what maybe didn't. And before we go any further, I need to talk about, like, you know, the amazingly talented people that helped me make this thing happen. I came to Leo. Leo and I worked together literally like 3 feet apart in the editorial pool at Paizo for about a year and a half. He was hired just a little bit before I was. He came on about a month or two prior to me. But those couple of months were a huge deal because he was in on Pathfinder playtest before I was, and was always kind of like one step ahead of me on all this stuff. And plus, he's just got tons more editing experience as a professional editor. And he's since been promoted to become the senior editor. First, he was senior editor, and then he became managing editor for the entire team. So, which is exactly the right call. That team could not be in better hands. But when I first came to him to write this, I picked him because I knew that he ran Starfinder every week. Like, he had a regular Starfinder game. His fiance and friends were all living in the Midwest, and so he would run Starfinder every week for them. And I really wanted that. I wanted somebody who had a week-to-week kind of handle on the mechanics of the game and really understood how this game runs from a practical standpoint and not simply a theoretical one. I mean, we can all read the books, and I'm not here to talk to browbeat people who don't get a chance to play these games. But when we're making the game, I really felt like it was important to get somebody who had an experienced GMing hand. And I thought he would bring a lot to it. Now, Leo ended up bringing a bunch of other stuff to this adventure path that I had I didn't even think about. And we'll talk about his unique life experience skills and how that showed up in the adventure path in a minute too. Kieran was our editing liaison. In other words, when I'm Kieran Newton, Kieran is an editor, and they joined the team a little bit after I did. And I only worked with Kieran directly as a fellow editor for a few months, but Kieran became the person that I spoke to when I had stuff I needed to relate to the entire editorial team about this AP. And Kieran in turn presented editorial concerns to me, and Kieran was vastly important and critical to the whole maturation of this AP, in particular its themes, keeping it on target and what we were trying to say about this adventure path. There's a lot of critiques about role-playing games, and one of those critiques is that role-playing games are about killing people and taking their stuff. And there's a lot of assumption that the story is basically just about violence. And I was trying to say something more with this adventure path. Specifically, I was trying to talk about the consequences of decisions that we make, and also the anti-capitalist nature of this AP, frankly, where people are stuck in this kind of like capitalistic dystopia where they have to work themselves to death just to stay alive, and the paradox that is, and that these people are part of a system that they hate and that does them poorly, but they nevertheless work to uphold it. And there's a reason why I call this sort of my Eat the Rich in Space story. Kieran's personal background identified with that kind of working class upbringing, much like I did. You know, I've said before, like my dad was a union guy, you know, he worked in a sheet metal shop his whole life. And this working for a living kind of adventure path, Kieran got that, you know, and of course, so did Leo. Like Leo comes from like a rural background, you know, where like, you know, his father raised horses and stuff and had a farm. And that kind of, you know, working all day long on the farm kind of stuff shows up in this AP in some really unexpected ways. But I loved it because I come from this urban working class background and Leo came from this rural working class. And together we were able to really, like, he thought of stuff that I would never have thought of, and it really brought the adventure into wonderful territory. So as we are wont to do, I want to talk about the back matter stuff and the things other than the adventure first. We will get to the adventure, needless to say, but we're going to talk about some other stuff first. And maybe the first thing we should start with is the starship, the Olafon. This is an exterior view of the Olafon, and here's our interior view. The construction of the Olafon and the idea about what it was going to look like and what it was going to do took up a lot of headspace for me and then for Leo as we worked over what we wanted the ship to be. And the ship has gotten some critiques from some players who find that it's not suitably heroic looking, right? It's not sleek and sexy and like a racer starship or a fighting starship. It has been described as looking like a Winnebago. And I am like, great. Like, I am all for that, because this is a adventure path about space truckers. And the more I can make your spaceship look like a giant truck flying through space, the better it is, in my opinion. And I don't, we were talking about when I first thought about the Olafon, I thought, okay, well, what, and by the way, it's named after the Olafon of John DeLay. And I believe that was one of Rob's names. He went through the old Pathfinder list trying to think of monsters that had the swallow whole power, because this is a cargo carrier. So it's designed to, like, you know, swallow things. So it's famous for its big cargo capacity. So what monsters have swallow whole? And when he said Olafon, I was like, oh, that's got to be it. Because, of course, I'm an old school Tolkien nerd. And any chance to have a Venn diagram that includes both Starfinder, Pathfinder, and Tolkien, I am right in the center of that baby. So yes, the Olafon is it, and it's named after the Olafon of John DeLay. But before it even got to that stage, I was thinking about what is the special ability of the Olafon? What makes it unique and new? How do we make the starship feel special? And we had talked about this a little bit last episode. I settled on this idea of null space cargo holds, the idea that it can carry more cargo than other starships of its size. that doesn't sound like a big deal. But when you're talking about a merchant game, when you're talking about characters where their ability to make money is based on how much cargo they can carry, the ability to carry more cargo is a huge deal. And my original concept for the Starship is that it would be a transport with five expansion bays, and they would all be null space cargo holds. So it would hold 10, it would have 10 cargo holds effectively, which is as much as a bulk cruiser, the largest transport, the largest cargo carrying ship in the Starfinder setting. So you would have this ship like the size of the Millennium Falcon or something, or Serenity, which could carry as much as, you know, the big Corellian jobs. And that would be a big deal for the characters. They would appreciate that because they could carry so much cargo, and that means they could make twice as much money on every trip. And the merchant rules, the subsystem that I created with Jason Keeley's help to do all that economics was built kind of on the assumption that the players would have access to a lot of cargo holds, that they would have twice as many cargo holds as a regular transport. Well, Leo and I, Leo pitched a lot of, we sat down in the breakout room and kind of brainstormed how we wanted this to work. We thought about the cargo holds and how is that going to work. At one point, I was really big on this idea of like a column for the cargo hold, where like every time you would open up, the cargo hold would go up and down, would slide up and down, and you could load it from the ground, and or you could access it from inside the ship. And it would be kind of like this separate cylinder. And because it's a null space cargo hold, like every time you open the door, it will be a separate cylinder. Like it would be a brand new, you know, so you could sort of rotate the thing, open up the door, and it'd be an empty room again, and rotate it again and open up the door, be another empty room. We kept playing around with it. We thought about, well, it's called the Oliphant of Jondalé. Maybe it should look like an elephant somehow. And we experimented with that. And then that's when I realized, well, we can't do that because Slave One is shaped like an elephant, right? Boba Fett's famous starship, which we have all recently seen in The Mandalorian, that flies around like a giant elephant head, which of course makes perfect sense for a bounty hunter. It's like a little bit too thematically on point, to be frank. But I thought, well, for a minute we toyed around with that. We couldn't get it to work. And finally, Leo came to me with a big pencil sketch on graph paper of a starship, which looks virtually identical to what you have here. And in particular, what's notable about it is that the engines are on the front. Those thrusters, those great big rectangular thrusters up front, rotate independently of the ship so that the ship can do all kinds of crazy maneuvers with the thrusters, and the thrusters can be at odd angles for the starship, and it can like land like this, or it can, you know, fly upside down or whatever it wants, because those thrusters rotate, and this gives it some really neat moving abilities, which we, of course, it's hard to replicate or hard to really convey in an adventure path, which is a written text. But, you know, if we ever get this thing animated, like, it's going to kick ass, right? And it felt like something that a GM could really grab onto and the players could really play with. And I loved it. I loved that idea. I also really loved the asymmetrical nature of the starship. You'll notice that, like, it's got this, I have to point right in the right direction. It's got this turret on the top, right? It's got like a command deck, and on top of the command deck is a turret. And the turret isn't in the center. It's a little bit off to the side. And the interiors make all of that really clear. Like, we've got multiple decks here. And we almost never do this. Most interior starship maps are one-deck starships, and they end up looking really fat and kind of wide. You know, they look like giant manta rays or something. And that's okay once or twice, but when every starship looks that way, it begins to be a bit, you know, kind of uninteresting. And so here we were able to do multiple decks on one map. The figuring out how to illustrate the cargo hold was a challenge because, of course, it fills more space than it does on the map. So we ended up using dotted lines to kind of simulate how big the cargo hold is from the inside as compared to the outside, because it's like a TARDIS, right? How do you depict that? But then, one of the things that we knew going into as this particular adventure came along is that it was going to come in pretty hot, which I mean it was going to come in. We were not going to have a lot of time to develop it. It needed to move through my hands really fast, and I ended up having to do the art orders for this adventure quite early, and that included figuring out the cover. Like, okay, so the cover has the Oliphant on it, and I wanted that on purpose. The Oliphant is storm running. Storm running is this really interesting occupation in the Starfinder setting. So we've established, and this is all in Near Space, that in our Near Space book, that gas giants, specifically this gas giant in the Vescarium, but we expanded that to include other gas giants as well, that on gas giant planets, valuable minerals get ejected forcibly out of the interior of the gas giant, and they shoot up through the atmosphere, and adventurous individuals known as storm runners live in this storm atmosphere of the outer edge of a gas giant, and they fly their ships around with giant nets catching these valuable minerals. I couldn't pass that up, man. Like, that is just too damn good. And I actually got to write the storm runner archetype for the Near Space book. Well, that is a working for a living thing. Like, that, okay, we're here to do, we're doing a job, but the job is extremely dangerous. And it a little bit reminded me of that wonderful bit from the Stardust film where they're catching thunderbolts in their flying pirate ship, you know. So anyway, my point was that the cover has the Oliphant on it, and we send the cover briefs in months before the adventure. So I had to know what the starship looked like early. I didn't have time to debate anymore. So Leo gave me a sketch, and I was like, okay, make it look like this. And that's what we went with. And that's kind of how the starship came to be. And later, then Leo didn't give me the interiors for the ship until much later. And that's when we saw that instead of having 5 cargo holds on the inside, it had like an arcane laboratory and a tech lab and a holographic entertainment chamber and all kinds of stuff, which is very important to the plot. Like, there's this big, okay, we're spoiling a lot of the adventure path, right? Like, I want to make sure we clarify, we understand. I'm going to talk about specific events in the adventure. There's this long extended set piece sequence where animals you have taken on board your starship go berserk and are rampaging, stampeding through your starship. And it becomes this like multi-room hazard trap thing you have to resolve. And the fact that you've got an arcane lab and a tech lab and a holographic chamber and everything, that all makes that encounter much more interesting. And it makes the starship more interesting, right? So if you've got a mechanic on board or you've got a technomancer or something, like, they have a place to go and kind of do their stuff instead of just having 5 cargo bays, which would be kind of a boring ship, right? Boring layout. I mean, it would make financial sense, but it wouldn't be as interesting story-wise. And so Leo and I kind of compromised, and we put 2 of the cargo holds as null space cargo holds, which means that it's the equivalent of 4 cargo holds. But you still have all these other cool things on the ship, so you have places to go, and the ship feels cool. This was important because the players are going to be on the Oliphant for a long time, and we wanted it to feel like a place that's more than just the transportation. It needs to feel like a place where the ship itself is a cool setting where we have adventures. It's not just taking us from one cool location to another. And this stampede encounter, which is actually multiple encounters, it's basically a whole session of play when the stampede happens, is designed to really make you feel like the starship is an adventure location itself. And I think it worked out. It did not work out in the way that I first expected it to in the outline. But this is an indication of how an author can bring a new perspective and new elements to the adventure that work well. And I learned a lot from my collaboration with Leo on this particular element. All right, so that's the Oliphant. Let's talk about the Rival Crew. Now, see if I can get a little bit better shot of these guys for you. From the very beginning, in the outline of this book, I knew that there was going to be this rival crew of space merchants, of free traders, that the Pleiades were going to meet in Volume 2. And these were going to become recurring characters that sort of get up in the PC's grill or are their main competition throughout the adventures that remain in the volume. And why am I doing this? Well, on the one hand, I wanted to create recurring supporting characters. A lot of adventure paths get very modular. You have like one character who's kind of your guide through the adventure path. And we have that. We have Tarika. But most of the other adventures are kind of like, well, somebody shows up and then they're gone at the end of the adventure and you never see them again. I did not want this to be that AP. I wanted a lot of recurring character threads to come through. But also, I wanted to show the player characters that their choices impact the setting. That whether they choose to go left or right, whether they choose to be good people or selfish, whether they choose to be fair and honest with the people they interact with, or if they choose to be lying cheaters who are just here to collect money off your corpse. These are real decisions that have real impact on other living human beings in the setting, or living aliens in this case, on people in the setting. And the Rival Crew is my way to do that. So the players meet this other band of free traders. And the captain, Neva Rovo, the Usoki, I think she was originally some other kind of creature. I can't remember what. Oh, she was a dwarf. I was going to make her a dwarf. And I got some pushback that I was using too many legacy races. And that's cool. That's fine. Usoki are great. Like, okay, make her an Usoki. Okay. And then I left most of the rest of the crew up to Leo to come up with. I knew I needed to have one character that was good on the crew to be kind of the voice of the conscience, and also the one character on the crew that good characters, good player characters would like and identify with. The goal with the Rival Crew was to have characters that the players thought would be interesting and cool, that they would, yes, they would fight over a contract with, and they would outbid or maybe even rob. But when all that was over, they would sit down in a bar and buy each other drinks. And I also happen to be a big fan of like romantic subplots in adventures. And you can never choose a romance subplot for a player character because you just never know what character the player characters are going to find interesting or attractive or intriguing. And all you can do is put lots of interesting and intriguing characters out there and then keep your ear tuned and your eye out to see when a player decides that that character is kind of interesting. And they're like, I kind of like that character. I want to hang out with that character more. And then you have to like, you know, then that character becomes important, but you never know who the players are going to find interesting. And the crew of the Wintermourne is the ship. And Leo went back and forth on lots of different ideas for this. It's based on Neva's background. Neva's an old ice miner. And I wanted a character that was a working class character to be the captain. And then we knew that Neva had kind of a visual idea and her gear and everything, because again, I had to decide all that stuff for the cover. So that's the one character that we kind of knew visually what she looked like before the rest of the adventure path was written. And then I knew we needed to have one good character. And then I thought, well, let's have one character on the team that's evil. And then the others can be neutral. And Leo took that and came up with this wonderful and diverse cast. Jinx, the pilot, and from Verses, who's got a history of working for the cops, basically, but has now gone rogue. That's Jinx. Dizzy, the mechanic, technomancer? No, just mechanic. Yeah, mechanic, because they've got a drone. And their drone, which is based on the little Fox robots that we've got in Alien Archive 2. And Nemalith, the witch warper, who is the evil character, and she's a Heakley. She's the red-skinned Akatonian humans. And Nemalith posed an interesting challenge as well, because Leo wrote the character, and we managed to keep this, that Nemalith claims to be from an alternate dimension, an alternate reality, where Akaton was conquered, there was a war, and she's got a family and kids that are all in that alternate reality, that parallel dimension. Well, we haven't clarified that actually happens in Starfinder. Witch warpers can tap into an alternate realities, but the idea that there's like an alternate patch worlds, or that there's an infinite number of alternate patch worlds. There's maybe one where the Pact Worlds and the Vescarium didn't sign a treaty, or they're still at war, or where one of them got conquered by the Swarm, or the Mirror Universe Pact Worlds, if you will, where everyone wears a goatee or heavy eye makeup. We haven't actually clarified that that's how the universe works, right? And so we cast Nemalith as a person whose story is not confirmed. Like, they claim to be from this alternate Pact Worlds, where Akaton was the target of a invasion by the Kasatha. But there's no evidence that that story is true. And so maybe she is just making the whole thing up for some inscrutable reason of her own. And Dizzy, with their Squawk's companion, was also an important element in the story, and part of making the character likable, right? Like, give the character a cute animal, and I dug the Squawks because it reminded me of Daggett, the Boxy's robot dog from the old original Battlestar Galactica, and Jinx is deaf, which became a great way for us to portray a character who is not defined by their disability. They are a fantastic pilot, and they're shaped by their life experiences. And he knows sign language, and he's bonded with the Dragonkin, Dizzy. But he is also deaf, and the whole crew has learned sign language. And it's not his most important character trait. It's just a part of his life, and it's affected him and his life. And Leo spent a lot of time with some disability consultants to get that portrayal right, for which I commend him, because I would never have thought to make the character deaf. And this is a great example of the things that, what I've often said, like, the thing I love most about collaborating with creators is they come up with shit I never would have thought of. And that's really priceless. So the trick about the rival crew then becomes that the players keep interacting with them over multiple adventure paths. And it's very explicit in the AP that the rival crew model their future behavior on how the PCs treat them. So if the PCs are cool to them, fair, keep their word, then the rival crews start to drift towards good, and they become more honest and fair and more trustworthy. But if the PCs stab the rival crew in the back and break their word on them and treat them like adversaries, then the rival crew slide the other direction into selfish behavior and into evil. And this is, of course, exactly how all of us live our lives every day. Like, we have a huge impact on the people that are close to us, and the way we treat them affects how they live their lives, and how they treat us affects us. Like, we're fools if we don't acknowledge that the people we surround ourselves with affect our own behavior. Everybody out there who's like, I gotta start hanging with better people, because the people I'm hanging out with are bad for me. Like, yeah. right? And conversely, those of us that when we try to surround ourselves with people that are good for us, we're doing that on purpose. And that's an acknowledgement of the fact that other people's behavior affects us in our lives. And the Rival Crew is my attempt to reinforce that theme explicitly in the AP. All right, so the other back matter of this adventure, there's a couple of side jobs, and we've talked about the side jobs in previous episodes. They're like one session mini adventures, which I love. Like Keeley developed all of them, so I don't have a lot to say on them. But they're key. I think they're great and very helpful and useful to a GM, especially as a kind of springboard that the GM can use to go and get other stories from. I would love to have more side jobs in future adventure paths. I think you'll see something like them in future products. There's a great space in between the 35-page Starfighter adventure that takes you 3 months to play, or 2 months to play, and the one shot and the society play, where you're part of the organized society and you've got all that. And so can we give GMs some tools to help them do adventures that are using recurring characters but are self-contained and that you can kind of drop in anywhere? This is one of the thing where Starfinder's Alien Archive NPC construction rules really help us out, because if you like a side job, but it's designed for characters level four or whatever, and your characters are level seven, well, it's pretty simple to just go to the Alien Archive, open it up, and move those NPCs or monsters up from CR4 to CR7 using the arrays that we have in the back of Alien Archive. I mean, it takes a little time, but nothing, you can't just write pencil notes in your book or add some post-its, you know? So that's nice that our NPCs are scalable, very easily scalable. So all of these side jobs are very useful for characters at any level. And I love that about them. All right, let's get to the adventure. Well, these guys, Harvesters. That's it, Necro Harvesters. So as I mentioned, the adventure was coming in pretty hot. That happens. And that meant that we didn't have a lot of time, and it also meant that a lot of it was going to have to get cut. But I think that we kept a great solid adventure. We had to make some painful cuts. There was a lot of great stuff in here that we just did not have time and room for. When it was over, I was very surprised when I looked back on the adventure at how much the themes of how much this was an adventure that had horror themes or that was about death. The first section, you meet your contact. You meet your latest Mr. Johnson in a bar dedicated to the goddess, to Urgothoa, the goddess of corpses and undeath, a sickness, and your cargo is shipping necro augmentations made out of the magically infused corpses of other people. And the guy who you end up getting this cargo from is himself a necromancer who's making these things. And he's got these floating necro harvesters, which always kind of reminded me of Duke Leto from Dune. Or Baron Leto Harkonnen, excuse me. And that's just like the first part. That's like the part one of the adventure. But then it continues. Like you end up chased by We'll come back to the beautiful ranch scene. You get chased by this guy Creech, who is who's got these necrotic augmentations built into his body, so he's like a half undead cow guy, and you meet someone who's undead. You have a major NPC is undead. And it is even, and I was sort of joking with Leo at one point that we should have renamed this adventure Merchants of Death. But ultimately he said, well, you know, Merchants of the Void still kind of feels undeady or a little gloomy and grim. And I'm like, well, you're right. Like the void itself becomes our metaphor for death. And it's an interesting adventure. It's not what I expected it to be. But I should have expected it because Leo runs a pretty dark and moody game. Like he's always kind of doing this, this dark, gloomy, pretty heavy themes and stuff in his game. And I think he likes to horrify and scare his, creep him out his players a little bit. He enjoys that. And so he wrote an adventure where he got to do that. And it was unexpected, but it gives the adventure a really interesting feel. I also love the fact that your first cargo is carrying necrographs, because it's a great feel of like, well, we got to do the job, and delivering a bunch of these necrographs is kind of creepy, and I don't know if we really want people to be attaching magically infused dead flesh to their bodies, but I guess it's their choice and we have bills to pay. That great kind of gray zone, you know, that shades of gray that fills this adventure is emblematized even by the cargo you are carrying. And I loved that aspect of the adventure. So as an example, on things that had to get cut, there's this whole mystery about how the manufacturer of necrographs like blew up this passenger starship and framed a pirate captain for it. And then, you know, and all kinds of stuff are going down. And it was a big murder mystery with lots of clues everywhere. And we quite frankly had to just kind of slim it way down and make it something that the players did not have to solve. The clues are still there and the murder mystery is still there. Like who blew up the ship and how does that all connect to the major plot? It's all still in there, but the players no longer have to solve the mystery to get to the adventure, right? Like it's like a side quest. And if the players want to figure it out, they can. But if they don't, that's okay too. And I just had to kind of de-emphasize that a little bit in term just to save page count. But you know, that's the sacrifices that we make. This adventure could have been twice its length. But you know, and it would have been great. Like we would have had a lot of fun running and playing that adventure. But, you know, we just didn't have that kind of room. There's a lot of great, interesting NPCs and choices the players get to make in this first part of the adventure. For example, the players meet like this gang of three goblins. And I, any chance to put, the space goblins felt like a really good crossover with the themes of this game. Space goblins are like, you know, they're fun, but they're also like, you know, kind of, you know, they're sort of thieves, but they're not necessarily, I don't know. It seemed like a lot of potential there. That's why I had one of the first encounters in the first volume is with space goblins. And when I saw the goblins in this adventure, I was like, okay, yeah, great. And so you've got like one goblin these two goblins who are just fighting over everything. Like, what are we going to do with our treasure, you know? And one of the guy, and the other goblin's like, you're arguing over nothing and we're going to be stuck on this station forever. They're on Absalom Station. And instead he turns to the PCs and he says, look, we'll help you. We'll give you this thing that you need for free, but we want to get out of the station. Will you take us with you? Okay, so now we've got the players. This has no real bearing on the rest of the adventure. Like whether the goblins go with you or not is not key to anything. And so the players can decide, well, like, okay, are we willing to have these three space goblins on our ship for an undetermined amount of time while we find them a new home? Or are we going to just shoot them and take the stuff? Or are we going to buy it? Which is the good, evil, and neutral answers to this conundrum. And I love that. And it's just one real, it's just one self-contained encounter, really. And any of those answers work. The adventure continues to proceed forward regardless of what the players do. But they have some real flexibility. And Leo worked really hard to create those choices throughout the whole adventure path. He compared it to Knights of the Old Republic, like those great BioWare games, right? Where like you can make different choices and your kind of your light meter and dark meter kind of goes up and down as you make different choices. And those that light meter and dark meter is important at the end of the story. But you have choices. And let's give the players some interesting choices. In this case, the thing that you're getting from the goblins, and I wanted to stress this, like this goes back to the construction of the Oliphant. Like the players are not here to fight things. The Oliphant is not a warship. I didn't want it to be super fast or super sturdy or to have great big guns on it, because none of those things are required for you to be a good merchant. This is why Serenity has no guns on it, right? Because it's trying to be a little iconoclastic, a little deconstructive. Like let's have a starship that's got no guns. And the Oliphant does have weapons, but I wanted, because we have starship combat and that's fun and there's a lot of potential there. But we also wanted to, I wanted to illustrate that when it comes to upgrading your starship, maybe your priorities are a little bit different in this adventure path than they would be in others. In this case, if you're going from one place to another and your contracts depend on getting there on time and delivering, the faster you can get there and the less time you have to spend in the drift, the better. In other words, this is the first adventure path where a drift engine with a rating higher than one has any impact. So in this case, the Wintermourne get the contract ahead of you, but they've only got a drift engine with a rating of one. And if you can get a drift two engine, a signal booster, and you can install that on the Oliphant, well, you can leave later, but still get there first. And so you can scoop them and beat them out for the contract. And I wanted to illustrate that it's cargo capacity and drift travel that matter to the Oliphant, not the size of your shields or the size of your guns. Okay, so and that whole thing, like the whole first part could have been its whole adventure. There were so many twists and turns in it and so many great complex issues there. And Creech, for example, that we already mentioned, Creech originally showed up in the first part. And so his appearance in the second part is he's a returning character. And I had, with great regret, those all became deleted scenes. Like, you know, maybe one day in the extended cut version of Merchants of the Void, we'll have that whole scene where you find Creech basking in this huge vat of like raw meat. It was wild. Like it was awesome. And you have to have this whole conversation with him and his pet hound, Ghoul. And anyway, so there was all kinds of stuff going on there. And so then he ends up sort of chasing the PCs we had to cut it, but it's a great bit. So eventually the PCs, and another example of what was going on here, the PCs deliver the cargo to this Skittermander in the Vescarium. Much of this volume takes place in the Vescarium. I was really glad that we could do that. That was in the original outline. I wanted to go to as many different planets in the Vescarium as I could. The Near Space book had come out. And the Vescarium is a really important part of the overall Starfinder setting. We've often described the Vesk as kind of our Klingons in the sense of the role they fill in the narrative. Now, obviously, they are physically not like Klingons and their culture is different than Klingons, but they fulfill that role of the the enemy that you can still sometimes trust. Like if a Vesk gives his word and says, we'll be there with our ships in time to fight the bad guy, to fight the swarm or whatever, you can count on the Vesk being true to their word. Now, they might be lawful evil, but they will show up and they will do what they said they were going to do, sometimes in a way you're not too happy with. That was important for us. And we wanted to have a player character species that come, you know, the Vesk are this great sort of warrior culture, and their god is evil, but individual Vesk can be any alignment. And they allowed us to interrogate some of those themes and tropes. And so let's go to the Vescarium and let's see these oppressed people, because the Vesk have conquered. The Skittermanders, you can argue they didn't really have to conquer because they just showed up and the Skittermander was like, great, we'll help you. And you know, that kind of was a big, big anticlimax for the Vescarium invasion forces. But the other planets of the Vescarium, they've had to dominate. And it makes the Vescarium very unsympathetic. I mean, we are not into slavery in the Star Chamber. Like, we do not want oppressed peoples. But the Vescarium is an evil government. And so we visit some of these folks. And at the end of part one, you land on this planet and there's the Ishtikris are there. They're like the sort of long-headed squid people. And they're all sick from radiation in these ancient ruins that they're trying to protect. And this Skittermander nurse is like, well, I got these necrographs to help keep these Ishtikri alive. And thank God you're here. And there was a whole side quest here. Like there was like, okay, well, you want to find some other way to do this. Maybe you can save the Ishtikris without making them attach magically augmented dead body parts to themselves. And there was kind of a good way out. But we just didn't have room to keep it. And instead, you know, the nurse is like, okay, well, I'm here to pay you for your cargo. And the players can decide, well, this kind of stinks. Maybe we'll just let Neva do it. Or maybe we'll just not take the money. Or, I mean, they probably can't afford to do that because they need the money. They need the build points. They need the credits. So that kind of, it became a moment where they had to sort of swallow it and do something that they maybe didn't all agree or like. And maybe they would say, well, you know, it's just a necrograph. Like, there's nothing evil about a necrograph. They're good necromancers, right? Or maybe it's just neutral. Well, yeah, there's no alignment attached to having a necrograph, but it's, I think we can all agree it's less than ideal, right? Like, if the Ishtikris could protect their ancestral homeland without attaching an undead heart to their body, they probably would do that. So it became a tough choice, which is not necessarily, I mean, I don't think that's bad. Like, it's different than the other side quest that was here, but it's not a bad resolution in terms of plot, in terms of making the characters feel like they've got to make tough decisions and they live in that world of gray. And then they get the second quest, and we should go back to that wonderful bit. Everybody who's watched Firefly knows about the episode where they all haul a bunch of cows. They get a bunch of cows in the ship, and it's a great kind of tongue-in-cheek reference to the Western aspects of Firefly. So here we're doing a similar little bit where the players are recruited to herd wild Defrexes and bring them to a Skittermander ranch. I think I came across this because I was reading Near Space and I saw that they had Defrex ranches, and I'm like, okay, well, I clearly got to do something about that. Like, the players have to bring a cargo of wild Defrexes onto their starship and then have to carry it through the drift. And of course, something goes wrong, right? Like the Defrexes get loose, and now you've got a stampede of wild Defrexes on your starship while you are in the drift. Like, there's no budget on our special effects. We can do anything we want to, and so let's go crazy with it. And after I assigned the adventure to to Leo, he reminded me, hey, you know, I used to grow up with horses. Like, I know how this shit works. And I'm like, mind blown. You're right, you do. And he wrote this wonderful extended series of encounters where we adapted kind of the chase rules, not the vehicle chase rules from the core rule book, but the Starship chase rules from Starship Operations Manual. And if you have not seen those rules in Starship Operations Manual, it's great. Like, there's like 6 rounds in the chase, and the GM creates a particular obstacle in every one of those rounds. And then the players have like somebody's trying to fly the ship, and then they also have the obstacle. And so you've got multiple players making skill checks on every one of those rounds of the chase. And then whether you succeed in the chase or fail depends on how many total successes you got, not counting the obstacle. Like, the obstacles kind of make things harder or easier, depending on whether or not you succeed them. But then you've got the separate line of skill checks to actually succeed in the chase every round. And Leo took that and made it into the ranch sequence, where like every player kind of has a role in the herding, right? Are you like the scout or the leader or the guy who's in the back, like making sure the last cow catches up with the rest of the pack? And I would never have known to do any of that. Like, it was really a great example of him bringing his own personal experience and creating lots of hazards and interesting plot twists in this. So the players heard these defrexes, and there's a whole bunch of story that can happen, and there are all kinds of interesting role-playing opportunities in the hazards of the chase. And it gave me a chance to order this art, in which we put a couple of the iconics, Valoro and Barsala, Dr. B, herding giant badgers through a mountain canyon. And I was like, you can't. This scene could happen in no game but Starfinder, and I love it. But then, while they're in doing all of this, they get ambushed by Creech, and there's this great sequence. Creech and his pet dog, the skeleton hound ghoul, and all kinds of other things all go wrong, and the players are getting shot at, and he's a bounty hunter, basically, he's an assassin sent by Edgecorp. And it's a trap situation where the players fight off the assassin and they save their herd of defrexes, but it's actually all planting the trap of how the defrexes break loose on the starship later on. So it's kind of like a long extended plot. And the fact that Creech dies, pretty much whatever the players do, is part of Aline Rasora's plan. Like, she kind of needs him to die to make this happen, and it helps reinforce how exactly what kind of a person Aline has become in the years since her original move to Edgecorp in that short story I got to write, Opportunity Cost. Anyway, so then you've got all these various missions that you're doing in the Vescarium, and you kind of go from one Vescarian planet to the next, doing all these different odd jobs. And this is where Leo came to me and he said, listen, I have an idea. And there's a term for stories, a term called picaresque, which is where like the players kind of have, or the characters, the protagonists of the story kind of have these self-contained adventures. You know, old Star Trek was like this. I'm talking about Next Generation and original series, where you would have kind of a Planet of the Week story. And at the end of the episode, everybody was pretty much back where they were at the beginning of the episode. Like, it was very episodic, and there wasn't a lot of continuing story. And that self-containedness of the story was part of its appeal. It meant, in a gaming aspect, it meant that it was easier to run. You could pick individual sections from the adventure and kind of run them as their own little stories. So maybe the players just do the Defrex herding mission, for example, or maybe they just do the storm running mission, or maybe they just do the necrograft mission or whatever. And there's not a lot of continuity between. It's just kind of like, okay, it's another day, another job. This is Tuesday, it must be Vesk 4. But Leo didn't want to, he understood that. He's like, oh, he's totally on board with that. But he's like, but as I write this, I really want to give it an ending. Like, I want to give it an ending that feels that's a payoff for the many weeks of play the players have put into this adventure. And for that, there has to be a through line. There has to be a main plot. And I was like, okay, sure, okay, let's do that. Let's add a big plot. So he sort of rearranged it. So it was originally like a four-part adventure with like four different kind of self-contained, distinct jobs that the players are doing. And he tied these together so that starting with this part two and then leading into especially part three and four, it's really slowly builds towards this big plot where the players are sort of unintended. They don't really realize they're doing it, but they end up attracting the attention of this covert agency working within the Vescarium to preserve the Vescarium against all of its own all enemies, foreign and domestic. It's like the radicalized element within the Vescarium, and Leo named them the Adamant Scale. And the Adamant Scale is a secret organization broken up into cells, and it's kind of like a spy agency. But they're also waging wars against the Pact Worlds and any aspect of Vescarium culture that they perceive to be treasonous or less than totally dedicated to the Vescarium's cause. And what happens is that every character, every significant character the players meet ends up grabbed by the Adamant Scale and taken to this prison complex at the end of the adventure, where they're basically brainwashed. Their personality is altered. They're mentally interrogated on the machine to find out what the player characters know about the Adamant Scale. And that's and the Adamant Scale also has like these, they're making bioweapons that they're gonna use to like sterilize entire planets, and that they're bad news. They are Leo knows how to make really big scale, threatening evil villains. He can totally do that. And so he does. And the Adamant Scale are these bad guys. Now, the player characters don't really learn about them until about halfway through when they meet this Vescarium fugitive who has been set up as a terrorist, but who she insists she's just trying to do what's right. And the only crime she's had is not being fanatically loyal to the Empire. And the Adamant Scale has basically framed her. And there's a good Vesk cop after her. This leads to another one of these great moral choices where the players are eventually, if they find this woman, Renavaya the Gentle, I think. No, that's the villain at the end. They find this Vescarium fugitive, quote-unquote terrorist. And she explains everything about how the players are working for a good cop, but the cop is being fed bad information. And that she didn't do it. Like, she didn't use this bioweapon to sterilize an entire island, right? It's like a test for the ultimate, for the later project. I think the bioweapon like killed everybody in the city, and they blame it on her, and she's like, I didn't do it. And in fact, when I found out about it, I left, and that's when, and I know about these guys. I know about the Adamant Scale, and I'm going to tell you about them. And the players are left in a one of their recurring decision points in this adventure path, where is, okay, we were hired to bring in this person, and we're only going to get paid if we do it. They're bounty hunters in this part of the adventure. But we shouldn't. The right thing to do is to let this person go. In fact, here's the rival crew showing up to help them get away. So are we going to help her get away? Or are we going to bring her in and collect our credits? Knowing that it's not the right thing to do. And the adventure can go either way. Like there's an encounter either way. And this again starts to help to determine whether or not the crew of the Wintermoor and the rival crew, like how do they respond to the player characters? If they see that the player characters are out for the credits, then the Wintermoor crew also become more out for the credits, right? But if the player character's like, hey there, Neva and your crew, I'm glad you're here. You should take this purse, this Vesk, and get her out of here, get her to safety, and we'll handle the Vescarium troops that are coming to capture her in their starfighters. Or do you fight her and the rival crew peels off because their passenger is dead or captured? We got this great storm running sequence in part three, where the players end up doing the storm running once again. And I had to do this because I put on the cover. Like as soon as I knew that we had storm running on the cover, I had to make sure the players got to actually do it in the adventure. And it's just such a great dramatic action adventure thing. So they sort of rescue a starship of storm. They rescue a bunch of storm runners that are already out here. And then they have to do the job and bring the minerals back, and then they get their cut and they have to sell it. And the selling leads them to another underground market. And that's where, you know, more of the people they meet keep getting grabbed by the adamant scale until finally the players find out what's going on. And they find out that all of these people have been, in fact, their client, like the person they're supposed to sell the star metals that they got while storm running, their client has been put on this prison island. And at first they think that's the only person that's there, that is their client. This is the prison. And I guess Leo modeled this prison on an actual prison in one of the Scandinavian countries, where the prison is like on an island, and there's a bunch of these islands and there's no walls because where are you going to go? And everyone, its whole design sort of changed the whole idea of what imprisonment should be like. And it's more like you're just sort of living in this commune. But of course, because the adamant scale is here and we wanted to give it kind of a little bit more sinister turn to it. So in this case, when the players go to the prison and this island, I love this shot. I don't know why. It looks very cinematic to me. Those white buildings in front of you, that's a prison. And when they go there and they land, they expect to find just their client. But in fact, they find basically every important character they've met in the entire AP is here. From the space goblins, if they didn't take them along on the ship, or maybe even if they did, to the person who sold them the necrographs, to the person that made the necrographs for them, to the skittermanders that they helped, to, you know, everybody, the good Vescarium cop, everybody is here. And the storm runner, and they've all been like brainwashed to believe that to be model citizens of the Vescarium, right? So their personalities are radically different and they don't remember any of their former lives. And one of the rival crew is here. And so Dizzy, the good one, right? And the captain, Neva. And so the players have to go in there and liberate their client, but also along the way, think about, do they want to help everybody else that's here? And I worked with Kieran a lot on this last section of the adventure, because we were trying to figure out, okay, there's literally like two dozen people on this prison island and that the player characters have met. And how many can they rescue? And what do they have to do to rescue them? And how many skill rolls do we want to make, for example, before it becomes boring and just a die roll challenge? Do we want the players to have, how hard do we want the decision to be, where the players have to decide how many people can they save? And how many people do they not have room for on the ship? Or how many people do they not have time to save before? Originally, we had the cops coming. We had like the local, I think this is all set in the Marixa Republic, is where the prison is. And the Marixa Republic law enforcement were coming. And we were working on this particular adventure during the Black Lives Matter police protests here in Seattle. And Kieran was very uncomfortable with kind of our portrayal of the cops as a positive, with their portrayal, with their inclusion of cops at all in this part of the adventure. And so we eventually decided to make them robots, like they're like security drones instead, which I was fine with because, as you remember from previous volumes, this is the adventure path where you get fired by an AI. So the idea that people are getting replaced by robots was very on theme with the overall adventure path. Originally, there was a big kind of cataclysmic plot here where the Adam and Scale were constructing their death weapon that was gonna the bio plague that was gonna basically kill everybody on these islands, or maybe even everybody on the whole planet. I forget. They were using it as a test to like test out their weapon. And I cut it only because we had a very similar sequence earlier in the adventure, and I didn't want to feel like we were. There was kind of a like the Renovia the Gentle, the head. She had like a death switch, right? Where like you kill her and she gets a few words off and then everything starts falling apart. And there's a cinematic part of me that loved that, like the entire island just sort of collapsing as you run away. But I felt like if the players need to have time to negotiate the with the prisoners and get them onto the ship, like there's this whole skill challenge thing that has to happen, where the players are trying to persuade the prisoners to come with them when the prisoners are still brainwashed, like the effects haven't worn off yet. And so there's a lot of like diplomacy checks or intimidate checks or whatever, and or bluff checks, whatever you're rolling. And I felt like it wasn't, I had a hard time thinking of all of that happening while the island was also exploding. And so I felt like I kind of had to cut something, and I cut that. So there's still the threat of the oncoming security robots that are going to come and lock down the prison complex, but the ending is not quite as cinematically cataclysmic as it could have been. And you may decide that you disagree with that you want. So in that case, what you do is you have the Adamant Scales bioweapon under construction in their underground bunker, and the players find it and they can disarm it and prevent that from happening. And then when the attack happens, if you want, you can have that be much more physically dangerous. Like the players are constantly, you know, rolling reflex saving throws, or the building collapses on them and stuff like that. And then what I would recommend then is just have the prisoners that are there have the effect sort of wear off when you blow up the underground complex, and the prisoners are all like, they're back in their right minds and they're much easier for you to herd onto a starship. You can possibly do that in seconds instead of many minutes. Anyway, I want to briefly note that some of the challenges with art and ordering art for an adventure. This is one of the Adamant Talons, the enforcers of the Adamant Scale. They are vanguards. And since Character Operations Manual came out with a vanguard class, I have seen a recurring pattern in adventure path manuscripts that I'm sent, which is that the boss is always either a vanguard or has vanguard bodyguards protecting them. Vanguards are designed to be a tank, and they're really good at absorbing and deflecting damage. And so they are a natural go-to choice for the boss to have as minions. The only trouble is that it can be overused, but this is the first time that I'd had it, so we kept it. And the Adamant Talons are these Vesk vanguards, and they look pretty badass. I kind of like that whole Darth Vader thing they got going on. But I didn't know that Renovia the Gentle, the big boss, I didn't know that she was in the adventure until after I had to order the art. And so Renovia originally didn't have art. And that's not the only thing that had to get cut in terms of art in this adventure. Ghoul, that wonderful skeleton hound, that's the partner of Creech. The squawks the Squawk's drone that that Dizzy uses. None of those creatures got art originally in the book, and that was a deep regret. Like all those characters need art. But there's another chance, and we'll talk about this in a later episode. But after the adventure path is over, we do the pawn collection. And when the pawn collection comes out, we have room to order some additional art. And so all of these characters that aren't illustrated in the book, like Renovire the Gentle, the big bad at the end, Creech's unique animal companion, Ghoul, this sort of radioactive dog, skeletal dog, and the Squawk's drone all get counters. They all get pawns, and that means they also get art. And I was glad for that. It's not in the book, but we just didn't have room for them in the book. And that's kind of where we are on the adventure. I really like it. It's not exactly what I expected. I don't say that badly. That's a good thing. I love writers that surprise me. We ended up with a great cinematic finale. You fight Dizzy in like the security robot. She's been mind controlled. You rescue Neva from the mind control machine. And there's a lot of great stuff going on there. You get to make a lot of really tough moral and ethical choices. The consequences of those choices have real effect on the NPCs in the adventure. And yet it still supports the whole merchant, you know, kind of working class themes that the game really, that the adventure path really depend on. I've mentioned this on other shows, but once the characters get to a certain level, character level, the whole working class thing starts to fall apart. Like when your first, second, third, fourth, fifth level, you still feel like you have to work really hard to pay your bills. But once you get to seventh level and stuff, like the gear you carry is worth so many credits that you start to feel pretty rich, even if you're supposed to be poor. And so I really had to set that working class tone in these first couple of adventures because I knew I wouldn't be able to sustain it in later volumes. The adventure was going to have to go into different thematic places. And so these first two volumes are really key to that. And Leo did, he totally delivered. He totally delivered on everything I needed it to do. And he created these great bad guys and this wonderful faction of the Adamant Scale. Now their plot is thwarted by the PCs, but the Scale continues to exist. They're a little bit less anonymous than they were by the end of the adventure. There's a few more people out there that know about them. I think that's good. I think we want that plot to move forward. And the more they're exposed, the more they become, the more we can use them in the future. But the Adamant Scale is a great faction that we can use again later, much like Edge Corp is our big faction in the first volume. And we've often commented, and Leo has been in the forefront of this conversation, noting that in many ways, Starfinder doesn't have enough conflict in it, that there's all of these governments, the Vescarian, the Pact Worlds, the Aslanti Empire, and they're all either friends or isolated by long distances, and the Swarm is off, you know, doing its own thing, and everybody kind of gets along. This was important to Sutter and to the people who created the original Starfinder game, but it means that we don't really have, like, as Leo put it so wonderfully in one of our early meetings, who are Starfinder's Rune Lords? Who are the big bad guys of the Starfinder setting? And we don't really have any. Well, this adventure goes some way towards creating a great faction of big bad guys that we can use again later. And I would love to see more of these Adamant Scale and these Talons here, for example, and other plots that they have going underway, where maybe they ignite war between the Vescarian and the Pact Worlds because I think the Vescarian's getting soft, for example, or they oppress maybe there's a rebellion on one of the Vescarian planets and the Adamant Scale come in and crush it, right? And the players oppose them. There's so many great plots that you could do with that. And so thank you for watching and for listening. We will be back in a, I got to wait a few weeks for the next adventure to come out, but we'll turn to volume 3, Professional Courtesy by Joe Pacini. This is a different kind of adventure. You're not doing a job for money. Professional courtesy is the adventure where you do it for your friend, right? Which is another common plot in stories like this, where the working class characters bond together. So in this case, Tarika is like, hey, listen, we've been working together for a long time. I've helped you out. You've helped me out. I need a favor, and it's a big one. Can you help me? Can you look into my missing daughter and maybe bring her back from this water planet where she's been working on a terraforming project? And it's my, I asked Joe to watch The Abyss, the James Cameron's Abyss, for this adventure. And he turned in a wonderful, wonderful manuscript, which I'm delighted to, I'm very eager to talk about with you. But I don't think the book is out quite yet, so I want to wait till it comes out before we talk about it. Thanks again, gang. Follow me on Twitter. Ask questions. If you want to know about more about any of these things we've been talking about, please send me a note. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Comics, or you can post questions to this thread, and I will answer them in the thread here. Okay. Thanks, team. See you next time.